Hi and welcome back. This is Police Stories Podcast, episode 42. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year UK police career. Hopefully you found it interesting so far. We've talked about lots of different things and that will just continue. Lots of good downloads again this week, thank you. And seems to be more viewings on the YouTube channel as well, Police Stories Podcast on YouTube. Like I say, you've got the option on there of going on and adding comments if needs be, or if there was a question you particularly had, by all means. So this week we're going to continue on. So I've recently transferred into the Met, where we are in my career at this point, in the stories. And we're moving on to, we talked last week extensively about sort of area cars and RT cars. So by all means, go back to last week's episode if you just want to catch up or not too sure what I mean by area car. That'll pretty much cover it, I think, from last week. So on this particular incident, I was posted to the area car, and it was either a night shift or maybe a late shift. So I think I was due to finish at maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, or it could have been a night shift actually, which would have been like a 7 a.m. finish. So sort of 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. I think it was at the time. I remember it was a weekend, so a busy time, and certainly the place that I worked in South London, very busy town, lots of nightclubs, again, as we talked about extensively last week, lots of gangs as well. So you would virtually always expect some sort of gang type trouble, probably any night, but particularly at the weekend. Like I said, a lot of it was based around, you know, people feeling disrespected, you know, or dissed, you know, by other gang members. And that could just be simply someone looking at them the wrong way, or, you know, just wandering into the wrong area. It was all about postcodes, or a lot of it was in terms of geographical areas. You know, if you wandered onto someone else's turf, then there was going to be problems because you'd dissed them, you'd disrespected them. You know, it all sounds a bit ridiculous, as it did at the time to me, but people are literally living and dying, as we'll hear in this incident, because of this situation. So one of the issues was, obviously you have various nightclubs and they all kicked out at kind of 2 or 3 in the morning, and then you were left with this nightmarish sort of human soup of you know, hundreds if not thousands of partygoers that were drunk or drugged up, potentially from different gangs, you know, with all their different beef that they had with each other. And you know, they were all milling around in the same area in this sort of city centre, which was an absolute recipe for disaster and regularly went wrong, as you would see on the news at the time. And in fact, still to this day, it's happening for sure, because you see it on the news quite often pop up in and around London, particularly the sort of South London boroughs. So what happened was there was a very large central sort of bus station. And at this bus station, you know, there would be, I don't know, 20 or 30 different buses that would go off to various places. Now, normally during the week, you know, the buses would stop at midnight, say, or something like that. So they wouldn't run that late. But on the weekend, you had night buses. And this was put in place for sure so that we could get away all these different people, you know, that were milling around in this town centre area, and get them out of the town and away back to their beds, you know, hopefully safely, before either they'd been attacked or they'd had a chance to attack someone. And it worked quite well. Very quickly, you know, a bus can hold, I don't know, 50 odd people. So if you had, you know, a dozen buses all sort of heading out, then very quickly you could have hundreds of people away from the town, which is exactly what we wanted. So strategically, we would put, you know, uniform cops at the bus station and the train stations. You know, we'd have them dotted throughout the town, and then you'd have a certain amount of cars that were available to respond to sort of incidents to try and nip them in the bud. It wasn't perfect, and to be honest with you, if someone really wanted to get hold of somebody else with, you know, for bad purposes, whether that was to just have a punch up with them or to stab them or shoot them, you know, realistically it was going to happen. You know, we weren't going to be able to stop it. You might be able to, you know, cut it short and hopefully it wouldn't be as bad, but you know, you just weren't going to stop it, because if someone was that determined, it was going to happen. So on this particular night, I was posted to the area car, and I had a girl working with me, who was absolutely brilliant. Again, we discussed last week that the only people that got posted to the area car, you know, as operators, as they were called, were good people. You know, they were all good people on there. So we had excellent people working with us. And on this particular evening, my colleague was, you know, very switched on, her normal self. And we had this call out to, so where one of the night buses had gone out, it was to one of the local estates. And it had dropped off people. Unfortunately, it didn't kind of drop them off right in the middle of the estate. It dropped them off maybe a 10-minute walk from the estate. So it got them pretty close, but it didn't actually go into the estate to drop them off, which is a shame, because then once again, you've got all these same people that sort of want to get to each other in a very similar place, which was never ideal. So the call comes in, and probably the biggest calls of my career, weirdly, have always come in as the most sort of low level, you know. So this one again came in as disturbance on the night bus, you know, out at this particular estate, and that was all we got. And we were the closest, plus we were the area car, so we were sent, you know. So I remember it's quite a fast road to this particular location, so we went absolutely hammering off, and I think we were in one of the big Beamers, and we went hammering off in the BMW flat outs, this thing with blues on. And when we turned up, it was a sight that nobody wants to see, to be honest with you. There was at least 100 people milling about at this particular location. There was definitely sort of pockets of fighting. There was pushing and shoving. You could see the odd punch being thrown. We got out of the car, and bearing in mind now we're talking 3 o'clock in the morning, so obviously pitch black. A lot of very, very excitable, het up people here. Lots of screaming going on. Like I say, punches being thrown here and there. But the punches and the screaming seemed to be focused in one area. So we were the first car by some way there. And we had, I think, probably, it felt like hours, but it was probably only 5 to 8 minutes by ourselves before anyone arrived to back us up. But we could see that there was a problem in the crowd, and there was a grassy bank over the far side of where we were, and more people seemed to be milling about over there than others, and there was also some screams and things coming from over there. So we pushed our way through the crowd, and the thing is, you've got to remember that if you haven't got a fluorescent jacket on, you're just another person in black clothing, you know, in a black police uniform, and it's not instantly recognisable. If you've jumped out of the car to something, you know, bad, you haven't necessarily had a chance to put a hat on or whatever, so you're not instantly recognisable who you are. So even that, you have to bear in mind that when you're pushing your way through crowds and people, you know, they don't actually know who they are. So you need to be mindful of that. We got to the centre of this crowd, and when I started sort of peeling people back from the crowd and what was happening, I could see there was a couple of people kind of leaning over someone who was laying on the ground. He was face down. He was only a young lad. I think he was 17. Very skinny build, lying face down, not appearing to move, with two people sort of bent over him. Two women, from what I remember, and they were screaming and crying and very upset. And in the immediate surrounds, there was lots and lots of anger. You know, you could feel a real electric atmosphere there. So it was pretty apparent either something bad had happened or was about to happen. So I asked the girls, I tapped on the shoulder, said it was the police, and just said, can you just step back? I just need to have a look at him. Is he injured? You know him? And one of them, I think, said, yeah, I know him. He's, you know, from up the estate. He lives near me. And I said, well, can you just hang on, you know, because we need to get some details from you. At this point, I had no idea how bad it was. But I'd leant over him, and they told me his first name. So I said his first name, and I leaned over, and I just sort of got hold of his shoulder, and I just gave his shoulder a gentle shake, because he was face down, not moving. And I couldn't really see much of him, because all I could see was his back and his clothing. You know, I couldn't really sort of see any skin at this point, or colour, from a first aid point of view. So I gave him a shake, there was no response. Gave him another shake, no response. I thought, I need to flip him over to have a look at him. And unfortunately, as soon as I got hold of his shoulder and I went to turn him over to face up, so he was laying on his back, you got this terrible sound, and you'll hear different people call it different things. The last breath is one thing, agonal breathing is another thing. It's very like a very long kind of moan. And as I turned him over, you get the, it almost sounds like an organ or something, like an old organ, like piano type organ, you know, that would be played in a church or something. It's a very strange, deep sort of guttural sound. But I recognised it straight away. And technically, some people would say that was him taking his last breath. But the reality is, I think he'd taken his last breath sometime before that. But there's a certain amount of residual air left in the lungs. And of course, the process of me turning him over was enough for his, enough for his body and his lungs just to expel that air. So I very quickly realised, because then I could see the colour of his skin, he was incredibly pale and had bluing lips, you know, which is something called cyanosis, which means there's a lack of oxygen sort of getting around circulation-wise. So I realised it was, you know, pretty serious. When I turned him over, then I could also see that there was a lot of blood on his front, that his top was absolutely soaked in it. And somebody shouted out behind me that he'd been stabbed. And several other people started screaming and shouting that they knew who did it, and they were shouting names about who'd done it. And there was just, it was a complete sort of melee basically behind me. Somebody said he'd been stabbed. At that point, I didn't realise or know that that was true, but started pulling up his very blood-soaked top and could instantly see the stab wounds in his front, the front of his abdomen, in his stomach and his chest. And there was quite a few of them. So one thing you have to realise about stab wounds, and until I joined the police, I didn't really understand that stab wounds actually are not very impressive to look at. You know, slash wounds are different. You know, they open up body cavities, really, you know, very unpleasant to look at, and do look very sort of gruesome and gory. Excuse me, sorry. But stab wounds themselves are very, very tiny and unimpressive. They're just a tiny, thin slit. They almost look like, you know, if you'd, I don't know, cut your finger on a knife and you see this tiny little slit that doesn't look anything but actually is bleeding quite a bit. You know, that's what they look like, because you have to imagine the actual thickness of a blade, you know, no matter how wide it is really very, very thin. And this guy had been stabbed, well, I counted 8 stab wounds in the front of his chest. And the ones that are easy to miss are in the armpit. He also had one under each armpit, and they're very dangerous because you've got a lot of, you know, very major sort of blood vessels and arteries running under your armpits. And they're classic defensive wounds. If you imagine someone is coming at you and trying to stab up at you, so they're coming up and under, you know, to sort of stab, and you've got both your arms out, both your hands out to protect yourself, then obviously that leaves your armpits sort of open and exposed where you're trying to stop those blows coming in. So quite often the stab wounds are in armpits, and I got to learn and to understand that that was one of the first places to look, because the bleeding could be most serious from those areas, and also very easy to miss because of where they are. You know, they're tucked away, and if you now imagine an armpit with a lot of blood in it, really, really easy to miss those injuries. So I could see those. Now, at the time, we were so used to stabbings, and particularly with multiple injuries. We had our first aid kit with us, but bearing in mind, and we've spoken about this before some time ago, the first aid kits that the police had at the time were not very good. And also, because they were just sort of freely available in the car, they were generally used and abused by anyone that walked past. So, you know, a cop who's just, you know, cut his finger, or, you know, anything tiny, basically grazed his knee chasing someone or something, they tend to dive into the first aid kits and get out a plaster and get out a dressing and get out this and get out that, you know. So the stuff that was in there that was meant for a sort of fairly serious use got used quite often, and it wasn't unusual to open a bag. And so I'm going to have to pause that briefly because my dogs have started barking. What you'll have to do is imagine there's some dogs at the scene of this incident, and then that sets the scene for you, doesn't it? Dogs in the background. Apologies for that. I'm not clever enough to edit that out, so it might stay in. But that's the glamorous side of podcasting in a caravan. So yes, first aid kits, not very good at all. And quite often, open the bag to find very little in there. And don't forget that we were now kind of 100 yards away from where we parked the car as well, so I couldn't get to it quickly. And there was no way that I was going to leave my colleague at this point. But one thing we did carry with us, because we were so used to going out to stabbings, particularly with sort of multiple injuries, was we always had a roll of black sort of gaffer tape, you know, that was kind of clipped onto my belt. And what we would do is, you know, as a form of first aid, if they weren't leaking too much, because if they were bleeding very heavily, then it made it difficult. But in this occasion, it worked quite well. I was able to wipe off some of the blood with the rest of his top, and also you know, we had a couple of old t-shirts, I think, that were there that had been already discarded, where people had tried to you know, sort of do some first aid on this guy. So we were tearing off strips of black gaffer tape and basically putting them over the top of the stab wounds. But having seen the color of this guy and having heard what I did when I rolled him over, you know, I was about as sure as I could be that he was not going to survive, and that chances are he was almost certainly already dead. So imagine we've got these, you know, this absolute chaotic scene now, screaming and shouting. People are very aware that I think this guy had been stabbed. Lots of people shouting out the name and what are we going to do about it? The police were useless, etc. And then from behind, while I was bent over trying to deal with this guy, now your average normal person thinks that cop is trying to help someone, you know, I will, you know, give them some space, or I'll keep away, or whatever. But when people's emotions are, you know, absolutely heightened, and with what was going on, we were actually, and people can't just get over the fact that they hate the police. It doesn't matter that we're trying to help someone. So it's quite frustrating. But what was happening was we were actually being spat on from behind while I was trying to do first aid on this guy, while I was trying to put my bits of gaffer tape over his stab wounds. We were then getting punched. Several times I got punched in the back of the head and in the back. Now, it didn't really go through my mind at the time because I was also wrapped up in what I was doing. But every person I've ever spoken to that's been stabbed and has survived will tell you that to be stabbed feels like being punched. You know, you're aware that you've been punched. And then quite often people say, oh, well, I put my hand down because it was aching a bit where I'd been punched, and realized that my hand was covered in blood and that actually I'd been stabbed. So every time I was getting punched, I was equally, now we have body armor on, but bearing in mind that, you know, it only covers so much, your neck's exposed, your armpits, which we've already discussed, are very exposed, you know, your arms and lots of other places, your legs, your back, etc., are exposed still, even with body armor on. So when I was getting punched, I kept sort of having a feel back and making sure that there was no blood there on me, because we weren't sure, you know, I wasn't sure, was I being stabbed, you know, or was I just being punched, as well as all the spit, of course. So we were being screamed at hysterically by people to do something, yet here we were doing something, you know, whilst being punched and spat on, you know. So it was not a nice place to be, to be honest with you. And I was very aware of my colleague as well next to me. You know, she only had about 3 years in the police, I think. So I thought that she probably hadn't been in this scenario before. And to be honest with you, even though I had about 15 years in at this point, I hadn't been in this exact scenario before either. But I very much felt the pressure that it was me to sort of take charge and, you know, to try and run this initially. So obviously I was onto my radio straight away and put up that we need more units. Male's been stabbed. You know, that was what I put. We spoke about it, I think, last week or the week before, about you've got to be careful how shrill and high pitched you sound when you put that up. And that tends to affect just how many people come. But to be honest with you, putting up a call that, you know, you're dealing with a stabbing, suspect unknown, you know, could be nearby, then that will definitely get people's ears pricked up, you know, and they'll be coming. So I was aware we had a lot of resources on the way, and I could actually hear them calling up, because where we were geographically was right on the edge of about two other borders to different, you know, areas, police areas, and that would have, you know, all the resources we had, again, as we spoke about a few weeks back. So I knew there was a lot of resources coming, and I could hear them calling up on the radio as I was trying to deal with this guy. So we went straight into CPR with this guy, but again, I just knew it was a lost cause. We were busy pumping away on his chest, as we'd been trained to do. And the more I was pumping, you know, the more the blood was coming out of the stab wounds, you know, so it just wasn't helping. But the tape was staying on and was, you know, in my mind, doing something to help. The first aid training you receive is very good, you know, even at the basic level. And of course, what they do is they refresh you very often as well. So sometimes once a year, sometimes twice a year, you'd be having sort of advanced first aid training that would cover all your, you know, your basics, your broken bones and your sort of minor bleeds and things. But it would also cover serious things like stabbing, shooting, etc. And we carried some more advanced stuff for dealing with those. There's something, a chest seal that comes that is able to be put onto a puncture wound in a chest, for example, that may have come from a gunshot or a knife. You know, that's a very good bit of kit, and we were trained on that. And the other one that would happen is quite often people would be slashed with large weapons. They're called sort of zombie knives now, but certainly at the time it was machetes. And within the first aid kits, you always carried a hazardous waste bag, you know, which was like a bright yellow plastic bag that you put anything that may have been, you know, sort of bloodstained in, just to make sure that it wasn't, you know, wasn't going to cause any problems. But we actually found out that they came in sterile packs originally, so you could open them out of a plastic pack and they were sterile to start with. And what was happening was, I never did this, but I heard of it several times, and certainly it's something they always used to push out to us at a first aid training. If somebody had been slashed across the stomach with a machete, you might find that literally their innards, you know, their intestines and what have you, were hanging out through the big slash wound, because machetes make horrendous injuries. And what would happen is we would actually put one of these hazardous waste bags across the intestines, because we're desperately trying to stop, firstly, them coming out, but secondly, you know, infection getting in, which is more likely to be the killer, I believe. So you would wrap their stomach and their intestines around with one of these bags, and then you'd literally sort of tape or bandage around their middle to try and hold it all in. And in fact, sometimes you even encourage them, believe it or not, to actually hold the bag, you know, close into themselves and put pressure on themselves, because again, you might have multiple victims or you know, or the offender still at large, very nearby with a machete. So difficult to deal with, but I'd heard of that being used several times like that. I mean, it's a crazy scene to think, you know, in a sort of central London, here you are, someone holding their you know, sort of abdomen contents in with a plastic bag around them, you know, but horrendous stuff, really. Anyway, so back to the incident, and we started on the CPR. We were really just crossing our fingers and hoping we weren't going to get stabbed as well. You know, as I said, these punches were raining down on us. We took it in turns to do CPR. Generally, you could do around about sort of 5 minutes or so before you'd swap out on the compressions, because I don't know if you've ever done CPR, but physically it's really, really tough, you know. And even though I was quite fit at that point, or certainly for me, you know, repeated sort of chest compressions of CPR is very, very tiring. And but we were swapping it out between me and my colleague, so I'd do 5 minutes, she'd do 5 minutes, and this is how we'd carry on. But within about 10 minutes, we had the first sort of police resources start turning up, and also we have ambulance on the scene as well, so we were able to hand over to them quite quickly. But to be honest with you, I knew the ambulance staff quite well, and when they turned up already, they took one look at him and what they were seeing, the colour of him, and were kind of, you know, sort of rolling their eyes a bit at me and shaking their head. You know, I knew it wasn't going to be good. So we switch now then from, you know, this initial first aid stage and the very quick evidence gathering that this is a guy who's been stabbed at least 8 times. There may be more wounds that I haven't found. I know it's gang related because several people are telling me what gang it is that's been involved, although I don't recognise the lad that's been stabbed. And again, you've got to know them all fairly quickly. But I keep getting this same name. Now, they all have, you know, nicknames and tags. No one uses their real first name. They all have these these silly nicknames. So this one name kept coming up all the time. And I put it out on the radio, and then very quickly the HAT team were there. So this is the Homicide Action Team. This was two people from a murder squad, detectives from a murder squad. They would turn up in the first instance, even though technically it wasn't a murder at this point, but I was already asked on the radio, how bad does it look? You know, and then you've got to be very careful what you say on the radio, because there's lots of people around still. So you need to take yourself off somewhere quiet, cover your mouth, cover your radio, and just say, it's not looking good. The ambulance will give me the heads up. They believe it's going to be fatal. So that then puts certain resources in place, you know, and gets people moving towards you. And yeah, so very quickly, within about 10 minutes, the HAT team were there. And what they do is they sort of firefight that initial hour, the golden hour of investigation into a murder, and establish, you know, to make sure that those sort of initial procedures have been kept. So things like the ambulance crew, making sure they leave all their kit there, all their bandages, their oxygen cylinders, everything, because, you know, that could have vital forensic evidence on it. If this has been a knife fight, a two-way knife fight, where they both had knives and maybe the offender's been stabbed as well as the victim, so the blood that you have splashed around, you know, may come from the offender, and it could be the absolute key part that, you know, puts them in prison in the end, because it'll prove that they were there at that scene at that time and bled there. So there's lots of things they put in place. At the same time, I had my inspector turning up. He would turn up quite quickly, and so would the other sergeants. You would expect them on scene quite quickly, because it's a major incident for sure, and they need to be taking charge of the resources and saying, okay, we need to start getting police tape up, we need to start sealing off the area. And also, because we were getting this suspect's name very quickly, now the suspect's name that was being put up was the leader of one of the local gangs, which we all knew, and we all knew where he lived. So the inspector was very quick. He got together a decent team of people and said, right, let's get straight out to that address. He's been put up as a named suspect, and let's see if he's at home, because he was only about a 10-minute walk from where we were. So that's exactly what happened. They put the crew together. They went out to the location. Now, I couldn't go, and the reason for that is something called cross-contamination. You have to be very, very careful. So imagine that I go to that house now, and I arrest the person, or even if I just set foot in the house, or he brushes past me as he's been arrested and put into the car. When it comes down to court and they do the detailed forensic analysis of his clothes and what have you, and they say, aha, we found, you know, the victim's blood splashed onto the suspect. Therefore, we can say he was there. He must be the offender. Happy days, tin medals. He's going to court. You know, he's going to prison for life. Of course, defense will turn around and go, well, hang on a sec. One of your cops that went to the scene and gave CPR and definitely got blood splashed on him, because for sure I did, because there was so much of it about, has now gone out to the scene where you found your suspect. The suspect has brushed past him, and that officer has transferred blood and DNA from the victim onto him. So anything you find is easily explainable, you know, because there's this cross-contamination issue. So I was absolutely not allowed anywhere near that scene. And it's something, you know, the police realised years ago. So it's very, very tightly controlled. If you've been to the scene of a murder or a serious assault or whatever it is, you play absolutely no role in the arrest, the subsequent arrest, you know, and search of any property. If you can, I mean, there are the odd occasion where if the offender is within your sight and it's literally just happened, then obviously you're not just going to say cross-contamination, I can't get involved, because, you know, you have to take a common sense approach and we'll sort it out afterwards. But because this was a little bit pre-planned, we were able to do exactly that. And so sure enough, the team go round to his house. Initially, he won't come to the door, this guy, the suspect. But eventually they see him through the window. So that gives them enough to have a power of entry under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. I don't think he let them in, so they had to force entry into the door. And he was keen to keep them out as long as he could, because what they found when they got in there was the washing machine was on and it was absolutely full of blood. And the, what he'd done is basically got home from having stabbed this guy to death. He'd immediately stripped off and thrown all his clothes into the washing machine on a 100-degree wash. He'd also thrown some bleach in there as well because he wanted to destroy all the forensic evidence. So rather than lose it all, that it was drained away, the quick-thinking cops on the scene basically ripped the plug socket out of the wall. It didn't matter that, you know, all the blood and water was still in there. They also took the drain off as well at the back because they did not want that that blood and evidence draining out of the washing machine and being lost forever. So it was a really good job. They were forensically switched on. They never did find the murder weapon, but like I say, it's a 10-minute walk from where the attack happened to where the guy lived. So almost certainly, and it's quite rural in places, so it could have been, although they had full-on what they're called pulsar teams, police search advisors that lead licensed search officers, LSOs, the cops love an acronym, so I'll try and keep up, but yeah, I'll try and keep remembering to tell you what they are. But yeah, a pulsar team, search teams had gone out and basically searched either side of the pedestrian sort of walkway between the two locations in an effort to find that murder weapon that had almost certainly been thrown into a nearby stream or river. So you potentially have a dive team out, which is exactly what I went on to do, as we'll discuss in some later episodes. But they never ever found the murder weapon. But to be honest with you, the evidence was so strong, and we had lots of witnesses who came forward and basically said who'd done the attack. And then of course you tie it in with having attended his address and finding the blood soaked clothes, you know, in that washing machine. He had an accomplice with him, another member of his gang who lived nearby, who was also arrested, same thing. He had DNA and trace evidence on his clothes. So very quickly, within probably 2 hours of the guy being stabbed, you know, we had the people in custody, and within a few hours of interviews, they were charged, you know, and the evidence was rock solid. They were never getting away with it. And that's exactly what happened. You know, they went off to court and they both got life sentences. So I say they'll never come out. That's probably naive on my part. They're certainly going to spend, you know, a very long time in prison for their part in this murder, which was, you know, about as horrific as it gets. And it was a difficult one to deal with because there's so much going on. You know, you've got all the issues of trying to deal with him, plus, you know, you're being spat on and punched. And in the back of your mind, you're aware that there's somebody, you know, who's willing to stab someone at least 8 times, you know, maybe knocking around in the crowd behind you, that also may have, you know, a sort of hatred for police. So quite a scary situation to be in. And the thing is, you can't sleep when you get home from a job like that. I think I finished at sort of 6 in the morning. You get home, there's either a short drive or a train journey home, and then you're basically just laying in bed, just looking up at the ceiling, because this, you know, you're on adrenaline still. It might be 10 hours later, you're still full of adrenaline. You can't get it out of your system, and you're just laying there not sleeping. And you know that that night, you know, once you've supposedly had a sleep, you've got to go back and do it all again. So there was a certain amount of counselling offered. The police are definitely getting better at that. They were rubbish, but they're getting better. Different forces call it different things. In Scotland, it's called TRIM. I think down in the Met, it was critical incident, but whatever it's called, it's an opportunity for people who've been to a very serious incident or a murder, or someone's lost their life, or a stabbing, or it can be anything really. If your sort of supervisor, your sergeant, your inspector feel that you may have been affected, or you've been to a particularly nasty incident, then this counselling is offered to you. And certainly I always took it and found it very useful, because it doesn't hurt just to talk through these things. Although some things did come back to haunt me, which again, we're going to go on to speak about in the future. So hopefully that was interesting. A murder, unfortunately, and a terrible crime. But it did feel good to be able to catch the, the people and get them sent away for a long time, especially so quickly. But there we go. So we'll be back next week with some more, and keep the downloads coming. Please mention it to anyone you think might be interested. I appreciate it. And we'll speak soon. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.